The following message is brought to you by Terry Moore. And now, Mr. Moore.
In any case, today is the Sabbath. It's the holy day. Every week we come around to the seventh day of the week. It's God's day. It's Christ's day, the master of the Sabbath. But today is somewhat unique in the sense that today is also Veterans Day, according at least to the Declaration of Congress in the year 1926. And while acceptable secular holidays are observed, such as Thanksgiving and Mother's Day and what have you by the Church of God, obviously any secular holiday observed or held on God's Sabbath or on any of his holy days is something that we don't necessarily keep. But there is something I think worth considering regarding Veterans Day. World War I officially ended when the Treaty of Versailles was signed on June 28th of 1919. However, fighting in World War I had ceased 7 months prior when an armistice between the Allied forces and Germany went into effect on the 11th hour of the 11th day of the 11th month. That is November 11th in 1918. And this is generally regarded as the end of World War I. 8 years later, the United States Congress released the following statement, and they said, whereas the 11th of November 1918 marked the cessation of the most destructive, sanguinary, and far-reaching war in human annals, and the resumption by the people of the United States of peaceful relations with other nations, which we hope may never again be severed, and whereas it is fitting that the recurring anniversary of this date should be commemorated with thanksgiving and prayer, and exercises designed to perpetuate peace through goodwill and mutual understanding between nations. And whereas the legislators of 27 of our states have already declared November 11th to be a legal holiday, therefore it be resolved by the Senate of House of Representatives concurring that the President of the United States is to issue a proclamation calling upon the officials to display the flag of the United States on all government buildings on November 11th. And inviting the people of the United States to observe in the day, in schools, in churches, and other suitable places with appropriate ceremonies of friendly relations with all other peoples. And so we see this holiday, when it was originally instituted, it was actually known as Armistice Day, meaning a ceasefire between hostile nations. But after World War II, in the year 1954, the 83rd Congress amended the act by striking out the word armistice and replacing it with the word veterans. And so we have Veterans Day that is kept by this country today on November 11th. And this past week, President Donald J. Trump released the following statement regarding the observance of Veterans Day, and he wrote, "On Veterans Day, we honor all Americans who have served in the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard, both in times of war and peace. And for nearly 100 years, he said, since the end of World War I, Veterans Day has given us a time to pay due respect to our veterans who have passed the torch of liberty from one generation to the next. I humbly thank our veterans and their families as we remember and honor their service and their sacrifice. And I encourage all Americans to recognize the fortitude and sacrifice of our veterans through public ceremonies and private thoughts and prayers." And so after reading this, I thought, what a good idea. You know, most of us can relate to President Trump's sentiment in his letter, his official document from the White House. Many of us know individuals that have served in the military, or some, you know, we might know one or more individuals that have served at some point in their lives. And in a world that is driven by self-interest, there is a need, therefore, for armed forces, we see, a form of defense, and also at times a form of offense to fight for what is right, to fight, that is, for justice. And so there is, and there should be, a sense of honor, that is, respect, that is given to those individuals who have put their lives on the line for the sake of others. And so in America, and in most developed countries around the world, there are branches of service we know as the Army, Navy, Air Force, Marines, and Coast Guard in some countries. They don't have a coastline, so it's called, I think, National Guard in some places. But these units or branches might have subunits that are known as like Recon or the Navy SEALs or Green Berets and many others. I think over the years there have been 12 to 17 different subunits of these forces in America anyway. But all of them are designed to fulfill specific duties to the people of the country that they serve. And in this way, they serve people by self-sacrifice and service during times of peace, as well as during times, especially, particularly during times of war. But that is not the focus of the message today. There exists another type of veteran that you and I are very familiar with, and it's of great interest to all of us as Christians. See, my focus today is veterans of the Bible. Men and women who have a long history of service, faithful service and self-sacrifice to God and to His people. And I would like to suggest that these individuals should be remembered and should be given due respect, not on this day only, but every day of our lives. And so let's go over to Ephesians in chapter 6. Christ said that in the end time there would be wars and rumors of wars, but to a lesser degree, this has always been the case. There's been relatively little, small amount of time that the world has seen overall peace. And even since the year 1400, which is the last 600 years or so of human history, there have been over 3,700 major conflicts around the world. And since the beginning of recorded history, it's estimated that there have been more than 200,000 wars, claiming billions of lives. And many of these conflicts, they lasted several months or perhaps a few years. Some of them lasted decades, though. Some lasted centuries and were passed down from generation to generation to the children, to the children's children, and the children's children's children of all of those individuals who actually started the fight in the first place. A few examples: the Seleucid-Parthia War involved the Seleucid Empire of Persia, learn to talk one of these days, and they were fighting against the state of Parthia. And this lasted 109 years in the 2nd and 3rd centuries B.C. Contenders for the French throne fought for 116 years between 1337 and 1453. The Byzantine-Ottoman Wars were a decisive series of battles that stretched a long period of 214 years. The Roman-Persian Wars was a series of conflicts that took place over a period of 721 years. This was between the Roman Empire and successive empires of Iran, or what's known today as Iran. But even today, there are currently wars being fought around the world that began in 1947, in 1948, and in 1960, wars that still have casualties every year. One of the longest wars on record is the Iberian Religious Wars. It's also known as the Reconquista, or Quista. I'm not sure how that's pronounced. I'm not Spanish. But this was a war fought between Christian kingdoms and the Muslim Moors for control of the Spanish peninsula. And this conflict lasted 781 years. It's amazing. So we see that there are many wars that are fought by multiple generations, ongoing conflicts that are both secular and religious, and it seems to be just a part of our human history, something that we cannot shake at this time. And in fact, good versus evil is something that we have always known. And therefore, Veterans Day, that's celebrated in this country, I think it has a lot to do with our religion, our faith. Because you and I are part of an ongoing war. War against forces of evil that goes back generation after generation after generation, thousands of years even, all the way back to the time of Adam and Eve. In fact, the Bible frequently refers to Christians and our behavior, our faithful behavior as Christians, using military terms. And so the Apostle Paul referred to other believers such as Epaphroditus, Apphia, and Archippus as fellow soldiers. He wrote to the Corinthians and also to Timothy, explaining that Christians are actually engaged in a type of warfare. And he wrote to the Romans and to the Ephesians, stating that we are to suit up, in fact, in a spiritual form of armor and to brandish weapons, spiritual weapons ready to do combat. And so even though the battles that you and I struggle with may include clashes with certain individuals at times, we know that the real enemy, our true foe, is not any human being. Our fight is against powers of darkness. And Paul wrote this in Ephesians 6, and in verse 12, he said that we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against rulers of the darkness of this age, rulers of this world, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in heavenly places, referring to that's where these angels came from in the first place. A heavenly place, a spirit realm is where they exist. And so the sources of evil that you and I fight against are spiritual. And so because of this, the battles that Christians face on a day-to-day basis actually can be found on many fronts. We might have a skirmish with a coworker, or a clash with an auto mechanic, or our neighbor, or a fight with the tax man, or perhaps an argument with a college professor who just teaches evolution and just hates people that believe in the Bible or hates the principles of the Bible. But the combatants we see are not always in human form. They come in other forms as well. You know, if we own property, it may be that the land sometimes seems to work against us. You know, weeds and thorns and thistles keep springing up trying to destroy our crops. Maybe the livestock that we possess might be stricken with some forms of illness, and we have to fight to get through every season. And on the other hand, what about if we just live in a suburban home? There are times when things just seem to break down. One thing after another. It could be first the television breaks, then the toilet breaks, then the oven breaks down, then the lawnmower won't work, and then we're having problems with our car, and it just seems like things from all sides are combating us. And we get frustrated, you know, when life gets really hard to deal with. We're not sure what to do. And sometimes we lash out, even at others, even at those we love, because we are so frustrated at times. But our fight is not with them, and our fight is really not with the stuff. Our foe lies elsewhere. And then perhaps it is as we age, maybe our own bodies even begin to fail us at times. And sometimes it gets to be a fight just to get up and to we struggle to get through each day. Now, I understand that some of these situations could be time and chance. There is an essence of this that God allows to the people, but circumstances are not always just time and chance, because God allows a certain measure of power to the rulers of darkness. He allows temptations, in fact, to come upon God's people as a type of, he's giving us hands-on training, if you will. We're training as we go. We're right in the middle of the fight, but this is also training as well, preparing us for another time when we have a chance to rule in other struggles. 1 Timothy chapter 6, the point is we have real struggles in life, all of us do as Christian soldiers, and like most wars, the decisive factors of who will win the fight in the end cannot be found in any single skirmish. There are, of course, monumental conflicts, such as Abraham, you know, being told to offer up his son Isaac, and this was very telling to God for him. But all of us, all the veterans of faith of the Bible, have had numerous trials throughout our lives in this war we wage on evil. And James said that there are diverse temptations that are allowed by God in order to polish facets of our character. And he said that we should count it as joy. Not that we walk around smiling during our trials, but that this is going to be to our benefit as we learn something from it. And so in this way, there are numerous battles deciding who is going to be victorious in the end, who is going to be chosen in the end. And this is why Paul encouraged us in 1 Timothy 6 with a general statement that relates to every encounter that we have as Christian soldiers. He said, "But you, O man of God," speaking to Timothy, but for all of us, of course, "you, people of God, flee these things and pursue righteousness, godliness, faith, love, patience, gentleness. Fight the good fight of faith," he said, "and lay hold on eternal life." And so in order to be victorious in this war, we have to fight. Not just any old style of combat. No, jiu-jitsu and kung fu and karate is not going to do it. We have to fight the good fight. We have to fight using spiritual forces of good. And so some examples he gave in this scripture are fighting anger with gentleness, fighting sin with righteousness, fighting hatred with love, fighting discontentment with patience, having a sense of satisfaction and gratitude for what we do have and what we do get to enjoy. And so veterans of the Bible fought this good fight, and many of them can now claim victory in Christ. And they speak to us, therefore, from the pages of the Scriptures. They speak to us from the grave, even, that they fought the good fight unto the end. And their experiences that we read about every day, every week at least, you know, throughout the Bible when we study, these are the same kinds of experiences that you and I have, and the same type of fights or conflicts. And so the war against principalities, against powers, rulers of darkness, it has been passed down to us, hasn't it? From our ancestors, from other veterans who fought against these same rulers of darkness since ancient times. And so we fight against the same foes. But the fight, you know, it's not simply for our own life. It's not just for our own freedom that we wage war. Because like the veterans of the armed forces in this country, we fight for the lives and the freedom of others. And so the Christian soldier has a goal, don't we? We have a goal in mind of not just gaining eternal life for ourselves. I know that is a good motivator, isn't it? But we fight so that other women, other children, other men will have the opportunity for salvation, that we might be able to help them come to Christ so that others may live. And so we don't fight for medals of honor like many of the soldiers do today, but we fight for a crown of righteousness that will enable us to walk alongside the Lord of hosts, who sits with legions of angels at his control right now. And so we engage in combat on a daily basis against human nature, against sin, against the powers of this world and the ways of this world. And the enemy combatants are spiritual in nature, but they, of course, are not limited to devils. You know, sometimes we see that our struggles are with people, that they are with places, you know, they are with things at times. The media, for example, fights against us on a daily basis. Movies and television frequently take swings at Christians and their values. Schools and colleges around the world, particularly in so-called free countries such as America and Europe, they are waging war on the Bible and on God every day, therefore against us as well. But I think one of the most difficult foes can be found within our own minds. We are our own worst enemy, I think. And sometimes we really struggle to fend off the pulls of our flesh that try to lead us away from God. 2 Corinthians 10 Paul understood this inner battle well. And if you recall, and I'm not going to go there, but in Romans 7, he related that that there are things that we know are right, that we want to do and we should want to do, but we often do not do those things. And there are also things that we know are wrong, that we don't really want to do those things, we shouldn't want to do those things, but we often find ourselves doing them. It's an inner struggle, a conflict of interest, if you will, a battle that we fight internally. And he was relating these truths so that because they affect every one of us, everyone who is called, everyone who is given a measure of God's Holy Spirit. And so we all have something that pulls on our flesh that we struggle with. It's an ongoing battle. And even Christ said that he understood this, that he understood how we feel when he said that the Spirit is willing. It wants to do good, but the flesh is weak. It tries to pull us away from doing good. So the flesh carries a lot of weight with each of us, literally. It carries all of our weight. And it wants to feel good. It wants to feel pleasure. It wants it in many shapes and forms. And sin is pleasurable. If sin was not pleasurable, people would not sin. But there is a satisfaction that some people get from sin, as sick and twisted as it might be at some times. And on top of this, we see our flesh, it wants to avoid pain. It wants to avoid suffering, sometimes at any cost, even if it means we have to give in to sin and lie or steal or cheat a little bit. But the Spirit of God it meshes with our spirit. It combines with our spirit, and it helps to pull the lust of the flesh, or those feelings that we get of the flesh. It helps us to put those aside, to not give in to those lusts of the flesh and what it wants. But it's often a struggle. It's a struggle between spiritual forces, God's spirit, the human spirit, and of course Satan as a spirit. And Paul, he spoke of this inner struggle, and he gives a solution here in 2 Corinthians 10, in verses 3 through 5, when he said that we walk in the flesh, but we do not war according to the flesh, because the weapons of our warfare are not carnal, but mighty in God, pulling down strongholds, casting down arguments, every high thing that exalts itself against the knowledge of God, bringing every thought into captivity to the obedience of Christ. And so bringing every thought under control of being led by the obedience of God sounds great, but of course we know that's easier said than done. We fight a war of spiritual forces that's, you know, internal and often displayed externally. And though some wars have lasted decades or centuries even, we see that this one that we fight with, it has been going on for thousands of years since the beginning of human history. 1 Peter 2, it is a spiritual battle at its core, but it is often manifested in the flesh. People steal, they cheat, they blaspheme, criticize, and commit adultery or murder. You know, all these are all done with weapons of the flesh. If you think about it, the scriptures refer to even feet that run to do evil and hands that make haste to shed blood. And James, he called the tongue an unruly evil that is full of deadly poison. And he said this because of the harm that false and wicked and hurtful words can inflict on others, even poisoning the mind. Make no mistake about it, we are at war. And this is a war for life. And it is not just for our own lives. It is also for the lives of others. 1 Peter 2 and verse 11, the apostle wrote, "Beloved, I beg you as sojourners and pilgrims, abstain from fleshly lusts which war against the soul or life, and have your conduct honorable among the Gentiles." And when they speak of you as evildoers, that is today, they don't like you, they don't like your values, they may, by your good works which they observe, glorify God in the day of visitation. And so it's talking about the time when God's knowledge is going to become available to everyone, the day when God will visit the Gentiles or the unbelievers, if you will. And so how many of us, how many believers have honorable conduct all the time when we are among unbelievers? You know, we put on a tie and we march off to services and we put on our Sabbath faith, put our name badge on. I'm a Christian right here, right? And we do that at times when we're among brethren. But what is our behavior like the rest of the week? How do we treat people outside the church? You know, what kind of language do we use? What kind of entertainment do we allow ourselves to enjoy? How do we behave when there are not other church members around to keep us in check, you know? Will unbelievers be able to speak evil of us in that day of visitation because, you know, they caught us speaking disrespectfully or doing those things that are ungodly? What will be said of us at that time? Will we have been an example to them of how they should live? Or perhaps maybe an example of, well, this isn't really what true Christian behavior is like. Hebrews chapter 11. When we were called, we actually enlisted. Some might refer to it as being drafted into God's church, a calling, but actually we willingly enlisted, didn't we? We said to God, all that you have said, all of your commandments, your statutes, your laws, I will keep. We're committed to this fight, therefore. We're Christian soldiers, like those individuals that enlisted into the armed forces of this country. And like them, there is a standard of behavior that must be upheld. And no matter what the situation, no matter what the circumstance, we represent something that is beyond ourselves. We carry God's name, Christian, Christ, God's name. And so there is a code of conduct among the armed forces, and there is a code of conduct found in Christian soldiers, God's commandments, his statutes, his laws. And so we have to learn them, know them. We have to become honorable individuals, and we have to be willing to remain honorable, willing to forsake anything that's contrary to the way of God, if we hope to be, you know, his disciple. And this is what veterans of the Bible have done. Those individuals that have become heroes, champions of faith, people who were willing to give up everything that might have been important to them for God's sake. Abraham was told to forsake his own country, to pack up everything and head out to who knows where. He didn't even know where he was going. God said, trust me. And he went. Moses, he was brought up in Pharaoh's house, living a plush life, all kinds of pleasures at his fingertips. But he chose instead to suffer affliction with God's people, rather to enjoy the pleasures of sin for a time. Ruth, she chose to live a life of poverty in service and sacrifice to Naomi and to her God, rather than living with her own family back in her own country. And these are proven methods that work, tactics, if you will, of veterans of the Bible. Because the world has its veterans and its heroes, and we have our veterans too. We have a long list of people in the Scriptures who have fought the good fight, who have prevailed. And some of them are listed in the book of Hebrews, such as Abel and Noah and Abraham and Moses and Christ. Christ is mentioned throughout the entire book of Hebrews. And so we studied recently the books of Joshua and Judges, and we're going through Samuel. And we, of course, think, if you think about it, you can start adding people to the list. You know, Joshua and Deborah and Gideon. And all of these veterans, they fought valiantly. They overcame great obstacles. And they left us, therefore, an example of what a good soldier of God should be like. They're heroes. Champions. They gave their life for the sake of God and so that others may have opportunity. They didn't seek status, they didn't seek riches, but they sought something else, something that could not be offered by this age or this world in its present form. And this is what an honorable soldier should do. And this is what we have been called to do. We have been called to walk in their footsteps. Now, Hebrews 11 is known as the faith chapter, and it lists several veterans of the Bible. But one in particular, I think of particular interest, is verse 4, when it says that by faith, Abel offered to God a more excellent sacrifice than Cain, through which he obtained witness that he was righteous, and God testified of his gifts, and through it he, being dead, still speaks. And so how does Abel still speak to us from the grave, being dead? Well, it's by his example. It's by the heroic efforts that he made to obey God in all things. And he was righteous. He made sacrifices that no ordinary human being would make, even his own brother. Now, the human tendency, of course, human nature, not influenced by God, its tendency is to want to keep things to ourselves. You know, the carnal mind, it doesn't want to tithe, doesn't want to give offerings to God. It's mine. I'll keep what, you know, my own earnings. But human nature, you know, and even when it does give, it wants to keep the best for itself. But we have the example of Abel here, who gave the best to God. He was willing to give everything to God if he had to. And this made Cain upset. He didn't like his brother for this. He saw him, instead of seeing him as a brother, he saw him as competition, an enemy. 1 John 3, so Cain, who's known as the wicked son, consider this. He believed in God. Yeah, it wasn't like he didn't know God. Like, I don't even know if this God exists. No, he didn't question that. Genesis 4, verse 6 even says that God spoke to Cain, and tried to give him some encouragement, some instruction. Here's what you need to do, Cain. Don't head down that path. Stay in the fight. Fight the good fight. Brother, your brother's not your enemy. But because his brother was more faithful than Cain, Cain coveted his good standing with God. He saw him as the enemy instead of seeing him as an inspiration, a role model. That's what he should have saw his brother as. But he didn't love him enough, I suppose, like a faithful brother should. And in this way, Abel's death still speaks to us. And the Apostle John recognized this in 1 John 3 and verse 11, where he said that this is the message that you heard from the beginning, that we should love one another. Not like Cain, who was of the wicked one and murdered his brother. That's not love. And why did he murder him? Well, because his works were evil and his brother's were righteous. So it was covetousness that Cain had. Covetous to the point of hatred, which, as we know, is the root of all murder. And this led him to actually murder his own brother. But we don't murder, do we? We would never murder other people in the Church of God today. We wouldn't kill our own brother and our own family. But what some do is they attack them verbally. You know, some throughout the wider Church of God might try to destroy the credibility of others, you know, or talking trash about them to others, pointing out their faults, you know, might try to criticize them through texts or emails we send around. But why do we do this? Why do we do this? Do we feel a need to try and validate our own selves by pointing out the faults of other believers? You know, in warfare, there's something that's called friendly fire and also collateral damage. But much of the damage, I think, happening in the wider Church of God today, it's not friendly, it's not collateral. It's often intentional by soldiers that should be fighting the same good fight. Because we are not each other's enemy. We know the enemy is somewhere else. The enemy is spiritual in nature. In the late 1600s, the French and the English were at war, and this involved colonies in the area known as Quebec in Canada today. Sir William Phipps was in charge of the British naval attack on Quebec. Now, the Catholic French in Quebec had hung a massive picture of a Virgin Mary and Christ, hoping that this would increase divine aid to their cause. But Sir William Phipps, he was a Protestant, and this didn't affect him at all. It seemed that his every gun on his fleet was aimed at that cathedral. Volley after volley was poured out onto that edifice. And in the meantime, the real enemy, the enemy forces, well, they were mounting attacks elsewhere. So Phipps, he spent so much time and ammunition firing at that place of worship that he did not have enough ammunition left to take on the real enemy in the ensuing battles. And so Sir William Phipps, he lost the battle for Quebec because of his desire to destroy a local church or congregation. Now this story, I think it illustrates something that is happening in the wider Church of God today. Phipps was a Protestant, but the Catholic Church is actually the mother of Protestantism, even though most Protestants would not admit it. The Bible calls it the whore, and the other churches her daughters. So Phipps went all out attacking what was really a fellow church that he didn't think was a part of his own. No, they're not like me, he thought. No, they're wicked, they're evil. He spent so much energy, so much resources on what is truly a ridiculous assault that he lost sight of the real enemy. And something similar is happening in the Church of God today. People are spending so much time, I think, some people, pointing fingers at other organizations, at other people in the church, that they are losing sight of who and what the real enemy is. Sometimes it's ourselves even, right? You know what they say, you point one finger out, you got three coming back at you. But the wider Church of God, I think, in this way, should be warned. We should all be warned, every one of us, myself included. You know, could it be that we're preparing ourselves to lose the real fight, the real battle? Christians are not immune to the prince of the power of the air. You see, we have the same spirit in man that can tune into his wavelength just like everybody else. We have the same pride of life that affects everyone else, the same lusts of the flesh and the lusts of the eyes, but there's something different about those who have been called and have been given a measure of God's Spirit. Because with God's Spirit working alongside our spirit, we actually have defenses. We actually have power, in a way, from God to fight this, to fight against it. That is, if we will listen, if we will pay attention to that small, still voice that gives us hints, that pushes us in the right direction. If we pay attention to really what's going on around us, who the real enemy is, and if we work at it. It takes work. Any good soldier is a worker. And so we're not at war with one another. We understand our warfare is really against sin. And in good soldiering, it takes a lot of discipline, self-discipline. It takes skill. It takes training. It takes execution of the abilities that you and I learn. And so we have to learn, well, what are the tactics of dark forces? You know, what is motivating some people? You know, and then we have to consciously make efforts to fight it, to fight the wiles of the devil. I think there's something dripping over there from the ceiling. In any case, today it seems that many Christian soldiers are not fighting the real foe, that, or at least they're making half-hearted efforts in doing so. And this is why Christ defined our era. He saw this coming. He knew it was going to happen. He defined our era as the lukewarm era of God's church. You know, the church that thinks it has the training, thinks it has the tools necessary, it thinks it has the armor of God and the sword of truth, but it's really, I think, in many ways, unprepared for the real battle. Psalm 37. We have the tools necessary, really, if you think about it. God is giving us the tools necessary to fight the real enemy. If we would just pick them up, if we had practiced using them. You know, we have the scriptures. We have access to God's Spirit. We have each other to lean on when necessary at times. We have been shown the way to God's kingdom, but do we have the will? You know, we're currently engaged in, as I had said, hands-on training. And even though we might feel like sometimes, well, I feel kind of alone in this fight. This is really difficult. You know, we're not really alone. We do have each other, yes, to lean on at times. We should be able and feel comfortable with going to one another to get some support. And we should be willing to support one another in our struggles. But even when it may seem that we are alone and that our enemies are on all sides, God is there for us. This is not news to us. But of course, that doesn't mean it's going to be easy. Consider an inspiring psalm in Psalm 37 and verses, I'll begin in verse 7, where a psalm of David states, he wrote or sang, "Rest in the eternal and wait patiently for him, and don't fret because of him who prospers in his way," those people that seem to be, you know, we are doing without while others are having plenty, "because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Don't fret. It only causes harm. Evildoers shall be cut off." Yes, one day they will. "But those who wait patiently on the eternal, they shall inherit the earth. In a little while, and the wicked shall be no more. Indeed, you will look carefully for his place, but it shall be no more. And the meek, these shall inherit the earth, shall delight themselves in the abundance of peace. And the wicked plots against the just, and the gnashes of him who, and with his teeth. The Eternal laughs at him, because he knows that his day is coming. And the wicked have drawn the sword and have bent their bow to cast down the poor and the needy, to slay those who are of upright conduct." See that happening today, don't we? "Their sword shall enter their own heart. Their bows shall be broken. A little that the righteous man has is better than the riches of many wicked. For the arms of the wicked shall be broken, but the Eternal upholds the righteous. The Eternal knows the days of the upright, and their inheritance shall be forever. And they shall not be ashamed in the evil time when judgment comes. In the days of famine they shall be satisfied, but the wicked, they shall perish. The enemies of the Eternal, like the splendor of the meadows, shall vanish into the smoke. They shall vanish away." So we all fall on occasion. We all have troubles. It is difficult. Being a Christian soldier, a true Christian soldier, is not an easy life. We all make mistakes even in this process. We all get caught up in some of the wrong choices that we make, and we might have to suffer some of the consequences. But God will not let us suffer beyond that which we are able. You know, we make enemies at times in the world because of a desire for righteousness. You know, our values are contrary to the way most people live in this world. And so we experience persecution because we don't have the same goals, the same values as much of the world. And, you know, we might become disappointed at times, as was expressed in this psalm, because, you know, we're not enjoying a lot of the other things that other people that are not following God are enjoying. But the Bible gives us a list of people, of veterans who did not compromise, who stood their moral ground no matter what, who chose the narrow path because it was the right thing to do. Not so that they could gain something in this life, because it was just good and just. And so God, in this process, he did not allow them to suffer irreparable harm. No. Daniel, we see he withstood the lion's den. Gideon and his faithful army of mere 500, these men destroyed an army of tens of thousands. Hananiah, Mishael, and Azariah, they survived being put into a fiery furnace. But does this kind of protection, this deliverance, if you will, does this apply only to them? Does this not seem real to us? What is our reality? I was asked in the sermon last week. No, it applies to us as well. We are included. We can be included among the veterans of the Bible who fought the good fight, even when all odds seemed to be against them. 1 Corinthians 10. You know, consider that God, he didn't stop Hananiah and Mishael and Azariah from being put into the fire. No, he didn't keep Daniel out of the lion's den. No, he didn't take Gideon and his army away from the battle, keeping them, you know, all protected somewhere else. No, he instructed them to go down and fight. Fight the good fight, the just cause. He allowed people to be put into these tough and these difficult, sometimes dire situations. But in all of it, he provided a way through it. And Paul related this in 1 Corinthians 10 and verse 13, where he said, "No temptation or trial has overtaken you except which is common to man. But God is faithful, who will not allow you to be tempted beyond what you are able, but with the temptation or trial will make also a way of escape, that you may be able to bear it." And so God's way of escape is not being taken out of the fire, out of the trial, but being shown a way through it, as Paul said, that you might be able to bear it. You can get through it. God will be there for us. And of course, we know this has its purpose, because we can not just survive, but we can be strengthened, that is made better for it, perfecting of the saints, gaining the experience, you know, developing the character that's necessary if we hope to become a decorated Christian soldier one day. 2 Timothy 2. Paul had related to Timothy, fellow disciple of Christ, in verses 3 and 4, 2 Timothy 2 and verse 3, he said, "You therefore," and he speaks to us as well, he said, "You therefore, you must endure hardship as a good soldier of Jesus Christ, because no one engaged in warfare entangles himself with the affairs of this life, that he may please him who enlisted him as a soldier." We've enlisted, brethren. This is our duty, our reasonable service. And the veterans of the Bible are people who endured hardship. They are people who trusted in God, their commander in chief. They are people of faith. We know faith is much more than simply claiming that we believe in God, because the veterans of the Bible are people that were faithful. That's what it refers to. It's living how God would have us live every day, all of the time, no matter what the situation or circumstance. And this is why the faith chapter of Hebrews, chapter 11, it has a list of faithful people. But it doesn't simply list these individuals and say, "Oh, these people believed in God and he took care of everything for them." No, Hebrews 11 gives a list of faithful individuals, and it says why they're considered faithful. Because of their works, because of what they did. They had the works of faith. And James, in fact, later wrote that that faith is non-existent if we don't have works to back it up. And so all of us have works. We all work at something every day. What kind of works do we have? Are they works of faith? We all bear fruits. What kind of fruits? The fruits of the Spirit or something else? You know, as good soldiers, we cannot say that we believe in God and we expect him to take care of everything for us. You know, Gideon had to fight. Noah had to build. Moses was given a work to do. The apostles were given a work to do. And the church of God ever since has been given a commission that is a work to do. And each of us, we have work to do in our own families or in the work, in our jobs or at school and even in the church. We all have a reasonable service to provide to God, to provide to Christ, to provide to one another even. It's our duty as good Christian soldiers, as Christ said in Luke 17 and verse 10. And so Solomon, one of the wisest men that ever lived, he experienced every way of man. He just wanted to experience, taste everything to see what's the point. What is there any value to any of this? Any of even the wicked ways when he felt, you know, obviously went way off track from God. But at the conclusion of his life, it boiled down to this. This is what he said in the final verse of Ecclesiastes. He said, revere, or not final verse, but in the final chapter. He said, revere God and keep his commandments, for this is the whole duty of mankind. It's our reasonable service. Revere God, fear him, and keep his commandments. Because God is calling the shots. He is the commander-in-chief, the master builder, the master planner. Live by every word that proceeds out of God's mouth. And by this, he's telling us how we are sure to be victorious in the end. Even though it might seem like we're losing ground today. No. Stay on track. Stay focused. And we will have victory in the end. In 2 Timothy chapter 4, in verse 7, Paul concluded this. Near the end of his life, he said this. He said, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. And Paul did this. And he wrote it down as a veteran of the Bible for us, an example for all of us. You know, he wrote prior in 1 Corinthians in chapter 11, to imitate me as an individual? No. He said, imitate or follow me as I follow Christ. In other words, if he's not following Christ, don't follow him. But he was an example because he was following Christ. But are we on the same page? Are we following Christ? Are we following the footsteps of the veterans of the Bible? Are we fighting the good fight? Or could it be, you know, that we kind of put on the Sabbath clothes and, you know, put on our name tag, I'm a Christian, and go off to services once a week. And once in a while we pull the name tag out and put it on when we're among other believers. But other times it's not really there. You know, are we really Christian soldiers, or are we just playing cowboys and Indians on occasion? Hebrews in chapter 11. At the 1993 annual meeting of the American Heart Association in Atlanta, Georgia, 300,000 people in the medical field gathered in various arenas to discuss, among other things, the importance of a low-fat diet when it comes to having a healthy heart. Yet during the meal times, they consumed fat-filled foods such as bacon, cheeseburgers, and French fries at about the same rate as people from other conventions that gathered in that location. And when one cardiologist was asked whether or not partaking in this type of food, this high-fat meal, was setting a bad example for others, he replied this. He said, oh no, not me. I took my name tag off. It's funny, but you see my point. Are we a Christian soldier every day, all the time, or just sometimes? You know, do we put the name tag on of being a Christian, but, you know, take the label off in certain situations? You know, who are our role models? Is it Christ? Are we looking at the examples of the veterans of the Bible, those who fought the good fight? After highlighting some of the heroic acts of Abraham, of Sarah, and David, and Moses, and others, it's written in Hebrews 11 and in verse 39, all these, it says, having obtained a good testimony through faith, did not receive the promise. In other words, they're not resurrected from the dead yet. Not yet. God having provided something better for us, that they should not be made perfect apart from us. So the faithful veterans of the Bible, they are asleep. They are in their graves right now, waiting for us to be like them. But what are we waiting for? You know, it's time to fulfill our duty as Christian soldiers. It's time to get with it. In verse 1 of chapter 12, therefore we also, since we are surrounded by so great a cloud of witnesses, let us lay aside every weight, the weight of the pulls of the flesh, lay aside every weight and the sin which so easily ensnares us, and let us run with endurance the race that is set before us. So we all have a sin, maybe more than one sin, that ensnares us at times, a weakness, something that raises its ugly head. You know, mark it, think about it, work at it. Pick one this week. Work at it every day. Bring every thought, as Paul said, unto the obedience of Christ. You know, Moses resisted evil. He fought the good fight. And he's promised a crown of righteousness. David resisted evil and fought the good fight. And he will be highly decorated for his efforts. Paul resisted and fought the good fight, even unto bloodshed. He was martyred for his faith, and we haven't fought unto bloodshed, not yet. Some of us might have to do so. Get ready for it. Start gaining the courage and the strength a good soldier has right now. You know, these veterans of the Bible, they deserve to be honored and even admired for what they have done for God and for God's people. They deserve our honor. They deserve our respect. And the best way for us to esteem them is to consider the examples that they left for us and for us to do the same thing, to display the same kind of righteous behavior. And so let's all work at it. Let's work at being more like Christ in speech, in activities, in our behavior, in our character. And let's strive to join the ranks of the faithful veterans of the Bible.